Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to episode 37 of the A24 Project here on the Nerd Party, the only podcast to take you through the back catalogue of A24 films, two films at a time, every fortnight. As well as pretty much guaranteeing you an interview with one of the people either in front or behind the camera of A24 every other week. I'm your co-host Dallas King, and with me as always is Lee Hutchison. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really glad to be back together again for a proper A24 Project episode.
I know, because listeners may not have realised, due to episodes seamlessly dropping every week in October, but we actually haven't recorded an episode together since September because of the London Film Festival and then post-festival holidays. But we're back, and for what actually turns out to be our first birthday episode. So happy birthday, Lee. How have you felt the first week of the project has gone?
Yeah, well, I think the first year has been absolutely beyond belief, really. Like, I remember sort of the A24 project, I think I've mentioned this before, was we were going to do like a top five A24 movies for like our other podcast, Filibuster. And I kind of had it for like a couple of years. I was like, I'd love to do like a podcast where we have like talk about two films at a time that are quite different, and we look at sort of the connections between the two. And just, I don't know how we sort of just like came to just like, you know, we should just go through the A24 filmography, but like, I think it's been kind of beyond my expectations, you know, the films that we how far we've got, you know, the kind of appearing in the Apple charts, like the opportunity to interview the people we have. It's been pretty crazy, and it's just, you know, I'm just really happy that it seems to be connecting with people, and people seem to be enjoying it and downloading it. What about for yourself?
I know it's great, because I think when it first sort of mentioned it on Facebook Messenger or something, it's like, oh, yeah, that sounds good. And then it was like, because like, oh yeah, I'm an A24 fan. And then when I saw the list, I was like, okay, maybe I'm not actually as big an A24 fan as I thought I was, because I actually haven't seen a lot of these. You know, I'd seen sort of the big hitters, and it only really sort of started to click in the last sort of 2 years for me, about, you know, I think around sort of Hereditary, First Reformed time. That's when I was like, these are really something special, this studio here. So I was really excited to sort of go into the back catalogue. And, you know, it started off as a fortnightly review show, and then, you know, you've been on a roll recently where it's now almost a weekly show with all the talent that you've been able to slide into their DMs on Twitter, so to speak.
Yeah, I know, we seem to have like, it's, you know, we sort of kind of just have been lucky, like with some of the people we've managed to get on. I think we've kind of got a nice mix of some of the kind of names that you think, like, you know, we've had the Bo Burnhams, the Millie Shapiros, you know, we've had you know, other people to kind of come where you think, oh yeah, like I instantly recognize that name, but also kind of looking at some of the lesser known names kind of behind the camera, on the in the cinema, and the sort of in smaller roles as well. You know, it's nice to try and get, you know, capture their experiences and what it's like to be in an A24 film in different capacities. I think we've been really lucky.
Absolutely, and I guess that could seamlessly bring us on to, if you want to maybe tease or plug who you've been recording with recently and who people can expect to hear next week.
Yeah, so we've kind of, in addition to ones we've kind of announced before, so next week we've got Krisha Fairchild, who will talk about her titular role in Krisha, and you'll find her in Waves as well. We have Catherine Olivier, who was in Eighth Grade, who played Kennedy. We've got Katie Chang, who plays the leader of the Bling Ring in December. And then we've got a bunch of new ones to announce as well. So this wasn't a film that we were a huge fan of, Barely Lethal, but director Kyle Newman came on to the show to talk about his kind of experiences on the film and take us really behind the scenes on that one, so that was really enjoyable. We've got the cast and crew of Waves, which is unbelievable, so we've got about 45 minutes of interviews from that. So this film is going to be dropping in America this month, but unfortunately we are embargoed till the UK date in January, so we have the main cast and we have Trey Edward Schultz for that one. We've got Claire Tran, who plays Mink in High Life. We'll have her in, I think, January, February time. That one was recorded today. And literally about 20 minutes ago, I finished recording an interview with Daniel Malik. So he is the voice of Black Phillip in The Witch, which is an absolute treat. So that's one to look forward to as well. And next week, me and you had the pleasure of interviewing Robert Eggers on the, at the Lighthouse premiere of London Film Festival together. So we're going to have that one next week. And on top of that, we have an interview this week with Chris... this week we have an interview with Joe Talbot, who is the co-writer and director of The Last Black Man in San Francisco. So I got to sit down with him at the London Film Festival for a quick discussion about the making of that film.
Fantastic. I mean, yeah, absolutely. You've been on a roll. And like you say, you're now almost into February now with the amount of content that we've got. So it's just fantastic. And congrats on you know, getting all these people locked down and interviewed and stuff like that. I can't wait to hear some of the results on that one. And so that moves us on to our regular feature, A24-Hour News. And, you know, we've always sort of been saying that, you know, sometimes we miss out on news because, you know, we normally record in advance. This one's actually being recorded very close to the date of release, which is a change for us. And, you know, there was a fair amount of news that came out over the last month. But the biggest news, I think, and the one that is very exciting for us, given that it's certainly at this first birthday stage, probably still our number one film each of A24. And that is that Jonathan Glazer, director of Under the Skin, is to make his first full feature film since Under the Skin. And it will be once again co-produced by A24 and Film 4, who released Under the Skin over here in the UK as well. Not much is known at this point in time, but it should be an adaptation of the novel Zone of Interest by Martin Amis. Set in Auschwitz during World War II, it would follow a Nazi officer who falls in love with the wife of the commandant of the camp. Now, for those who can't wait until that comes out, there's no confirmed release date yet. Just in the last sort of 24 hours, Jonathan Glazer has also just released a short film called The Fall, and that is available now on BBC iPlayer over here in the UK, and I think you could probably catch it on YouTube in the States as well. What did you make of this news, Lee, when it dropped?
Yeah, I was over the moon. I just remember just seeing it pop up. I think it was IndieWire that kind of broke it onto my feed, and I was like, yeah, I've kind of read a little bit about it. I don't want to know anything more until this film comes out. I'd love to try and avoid the trailer for this one, but I know I'm not going to be able to stay away from that when that drops. So yeah, it's exciting to see him coming back. And I think A24 said it kind of perfectly on tweets, like they're happy to wait 7 years for someone like Jonathan Glazer to come back. So I can't wait to see his take on such an interesting piece in history.
I know, and also another novel adaptation, because famously, I think it's fair to say that... Under the Skin is it's an adaptation of a novel, but I think it doesn't stick too closely to the novel, and he's taken it in a different sort of way. So it's going to be interesting to see what he does with this one. And you know, he's 3 for 3 for me. You know, he takes a lot of time between films, but you know, the first Sexy Beast, you know, showed Ben Kingsley in a completely different light and was fantastic. And then also Birth as well is a very underseen and underrated film, so it's interesting to see what he's got coming up with that. The next piece of news is that A24 and Apple are teaming up again. They announced a few months ago that Sofia Coppola was going to do a film called On the Rock, starring Rashida Jones and Bill Murray. That one is finished and will be released in the next couple of months. But now they have announced The Sky is Everywhere, an adaptation of a novel. And this is going to be directed by Josephine Decker, who came onto the scene this year and grabbed our attention, certainly, with a film that was recommended on Filibuster as part of 52 Films by Women. And that's Madeline's Madeline. Did you hear about this, Lee? And are you excited?
Yeah, Madeline's Madeline was one of the highlights of the year for me, and it's one of those ones I know people have this sort of lazy thing of, like, every indie film now could be like, oh, that could be like an A24 film, but you kind of watch that and you got the feeling that someone like her would eventually kind of make a film for A24. So I'm really excited to see what she does next. I mean, Madeline's Madeline is the only film I've seen of her filmography so far, so I'm really keen to kind of dive into her kind of other previous work and check that out, because Madeline's Madeline, I think, will definitely be in the top tier films of the year for me. So yeah, and another exciting kind of female director that's going to be coming to A24's filmography.
Absolutely. I mean, when we were doing I was doing some work over my break, sort of looking down at the stats of A24 and stuff, and I think there was, out of the 90 sort of 5 films that have been released so far, I think it was 17 had been directed by by women, so that's around about sort of just roughly about the 20% mark. So it's good to see that they're sort of doubling down on that and moving forward with the female talent. And I think for people who want to check out a bit more Josephine Decker, I believe a lot of her films sort of are on rotation on Mubi in the UK at the moment. So certainly a one way place to check them out as well. And the sort of final bit of news this week is that the race to the Oscars is up and running with the Gotham Award nominations that came out earlier this week. And it's fair to say that A24 did okay with Best Feature nominations for The Farewell, Waves and Uncut Gems, Breakthrough Director nomination for Joe Talbot for The Last Batman in San Francisco, Screenplay nominations for Lulu Wang for The Farewell and Joe Talbot and Jimmy Fails for The Last Batman in San Francisco, Best Actor for Willem Dafoe and Adam Sandler, Best Actress for Awkwafina and Florence Pugh for Midsommar, and then Breakthrough Actress for Julia Fox for Uncut Gems, Jonathan Majors for The Last Batman in San Francisco and Taylor Russell for Waves. So I think it's fair to say that, you know, A24, they, of course, were famously, infamously won the big one with Moonlight, but have had sort of other minor successes with sort of Ex Machina, Amy, and Room. But I think it's fair to say that they are going all out this year with multiple campaigns and are hoping for many nominations when it comes to the big one, don't you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think they sort of rested on their laurels a little last year. I think when it came to the Oscars, we sort of had all we had for it to show for it was a Best Original Screenplay nomination. This year, I think they're kind of going all out on all fronts, whether it's behind the scenes, it's, you know, production design, acting, films. I think this could be an really breakout year. It'll be interesting to see which one of them kind of potentially gets the most nominations. I have a sneaky feeling it might be The Farewell, potentially. But I'm going to be interested to see what sort of kind of really bubbles up in the coming months.
I know. I think, like, on paper, I think something like The Farewell is probably the safest option to get there. Uncut Gems and The Lighthouse are going to have a lot of fans, but I think given the content of the film and the filmmaking style, it's not going to appeal to everyone. So Farewell will certainly be a safer bet. Midsommar, I mean, certainly Florence Pugh, I think, could be in the shout with a Best Actress nomination for that. But I think they're going to do very well, and it's interesting. Waves, I think, was one on paper that sounded like I think it could get a major push as well. And you were lucky enough to see this one at the London Film Festival, so it brings us on to a quick recap of that. That was the only A24 film out of the five that turned up at the festival that I was unable to see. Now, I know you can't say anything, A, out of fears of spoiling it for me, and also, you know, we're going to get into them down the line when we do our full episodes. But we did a quick recap on Filibuster a couple of weeks ago, where we recapped what we thought of the London Film Festival. So we go into a bit more of a discussion in that. But if you just want to give us a wee snippet or taste, what was it like for you?
I think Waves is going to catch a lot of people by surprise. When I sort of talked with Trey Edward Schultz after seeing the film, that with the marketing, I think today A24 have dropped the second trailer. You watch this one, the first one, they feel like kind of mood pieces. You get things that are a little bit alluded to, but what makes this film so special is that they've kept kind of all the aces up their sleeve here. Like, it has an incredible structure, it has really interesting twists and turns. And where this film goes, it's quite dark as well, but full of quite a lot of hope as well. And I can see a film like this doing really well if it kind of finds the audience. I think it'll be interesting to see how people handle reviewing this film. I think if people can see it as soon as possible, I think they'll get the same experience I did of shock and wonder kind of going into this film. I think it's going to be one that could be easily ruined by critics potentially, so it'll be interesting to see how this one goes down. I think its marketing hasn't been as strong or as pushed as hard as perhaps The Lighthouse is at the moment, but I really hope Waves finds an audience, because I know Trey Edward Schultz's last film for you was a 5 out of 5 and a bit less for me. This one was a 5 out of 5 for me.
Well, hopefully it'll be another 5 out of 5 and I don't go the other way. Also watched at the London Film Festival, I think our pick for the entire festival was The Lighthouse. It was the first film I saw there, and nothing was really able to top it. It's just an incredible, visceral, maddening experience, with one of the best performances by a seagull in the history of cinema, I would say. Did it land for you?
Yeah, it's my new favourite film of the year. I absolutely loved The Lighthouse. I was worried I was a little too hyped going into it, but as I say, we'll get into it kind of down the line, but I just think this is a film that you just want people to see it, to take part in the conversation, to support a film like this. I thought it was just an absolute treat, and one that I loved. I think it had everything I was kind of hoping for in an original piece of cinema.
Absolutely, and we were lucky enough, as you briefly mentioned earlier, that we were lucky enough to speak to Robert Eggers on the red carpet for the gala of The Lighthouse, and we'll be bringing you that in a future episode. And we also saw one which has just been put onto the books for A24, and that was Saint Maud, a sort of interesting sort of British one of these termed elevated horrors. And this was one of the sort of surprises of the festival for many people. They hadn't heard about it going in, but it certainly left a bit of a lasting impression, didn't it?
Yeah, this was one I think you were quite excited for as soon as it got announced as an A24 film. This has shot up your kind of list. And I got to see it just before you, and I remember just being like, Dallas, you need to go see this film. I need to talk about it with you. I think this one is a really interesting combination of The Witch and First Reformed, which should get people excited. I think it's going to be out, obviously, 2020 some point in America, so I think it'll be similar to In Fabric. It'll be a bit of a wait for our American cousins to get this one, but well worth the wait, and I think it's going to become a real cult hit over here as well.
I think so. When you sort of said sort of First Reformed and The Witch, but you mentioned In Fabric there, and I think there's probably a bit of The Duke of Burgundy in there, his last film. I think there's a bit of an element of that in as well. So when you combine all three of those, you've got something really special. And then, of course, one that we were hoping for on one of a previous episode, and we were lucky enough to get Uncut Gems as the surprise film. I could see you sort of almost jumping up and down in glee when they mentioned that the filmmakers couldn't be here, but they'd film an intro, and you basically knew at that point it was going to be Uncut Gems. Did that one live up to the hype for you?
Yeah, oh my god, yeah. I've never been more invested in a game of basketball, not once but twice in my life. This was a film that I think has gone, you know, beyond even sort of good time. I think it's a masterpiece of, like, I remember sort of looking at my watch afterwards, and the heart rate had been going wild throughout this film. It's just so intense, and I think this is going to be one that it's going to get a bit of a rollout here in the UK, but I think Netflix has the international rights. So I think it'll be interesting to see how people connect with it at home. I know within sort of the confines of a cinema, it was the best way to watch a film like this. And I don't want to sort of spoil it before people see it, but I'm just desperate to hear what the public think of this one and what their reactions are.
Oh, I know what my reaction was, and it was a audible gasp, sort of almost leaping out of my chair at one point, because yeah, like you say, that basketball game is, even if you're not a basketball fan, you become completely invested. It's probably the most I've been invested in a sort of subplot element since Locke. I forgot to mention this on Filibuster, but it reminded me of Locke, where Tom Hardy is driving down basically to be at the birth of a child he's had in an affair, but he's on the phone the entire time to make sure that this concrete pour goes okay at the job he's just left and walked out on. And even though you never see anything, and it's, you don't find out, I left the film going, okay, he made it to see the birth of his child, but I really wanted to know how the concrete pour ended. So it was like that, it was the level of investment I had in that film, and it was a similar thing here. You just, like, you're entirely gripped in this basketball game at the end. But I mean, the basketball game is probably only about a sort of 20-30 minute segment of this film. It's everything that sort of leads up to that basically funnels you into that emotional buy-in, and yeah, it paid off dividends for me, and it's going to be interesting to see how this one plays when it lands, I think, on a limited cinema release in the UK in January, but then mostly on Netflix, so very excited for that one. And then the final A24 film at the festival was The Last Black Man in San Francisco. We were both able to see this one. I really enjoyed it. It was a really sort of beautiful, sort of poetic, lyrical look at sort of gentrification. It's almost a sort of reverse gentrification in San Francisco. You know, if you think of San Francisco in the films, you think Vertigo, The Rock, the room. This sort of showed a different side to the city, and I was really taken with some of the sort of filmmaking choices. The sort of opening 5 minutes of the two sort of best friends sort of skateboarding through the city was just one of the best openings of a film I've seen this year. And you know, you were lucky enough to sit down with Joe during the festival and chat about it, but what were your thoughts initially of when you saw the film?
Yeah, I like this one quite a bit. I think there's moments of absolute excellency, you know, the cinematography, the look of this film, how invested you get in things like skateboards, a house is just unbelievable. I think this is going to be a really promising career to follow Joe Talbot. And as you mentioned, I got the chance to sit down and talk with him, and you know, he kicks off by talking about sort of the reaction to the film and that. Yeah, here you go.
We've been very lucky. I mean, the truth is, when we finished the film, we finished it 4 days before Sundance, before the premiere. And so we went into Park City, which is high above altitude, and we're all sort of, you know, I think anxious and nervous to put this thing out in the world that we've been working on for 5 years at that point. And I wish I could say that I knew how people would respond. I think we thought that we made something that captured the city that Jimmy and I love, but you really don't know until you put it out there. So it's been really wonderful to see how it's been received and to talk to people afterwards, to hear stories from people that lived in San Francisco, or frankly from people who've never even been to San Francisco before, but are finding this connection with Jimmy, because sadly, I think what's happening there is happening everywhere. That's been sort of this, it's both, as a filmmaker, it's rewarding, as a human, it's sad, because it means that we're all seeing the cities that raised us become less recognizable. And I think people that historically made those cities the special places they are, especially in San Francisco, which was a haven for artists, for people that didn't fit into their small towns from other conservative parts of the country, they arrived, you know, in San Francisco to be the person that they couldn't be elsewhere. And now the city that once welcomed those groups is driving many of them out in waves. And so, you know, I think it's nice that it can be a point of conversation, I think, for people that have lived in the city a long time, as well as people moving there. Perhaps it'll give them a little more insight into what was there before them.
How did you go about bringing this to the big screen?
Jimmy and I grew up together in San Francisco, and so it's an unusual movie in that way. He's playing a character that shares his name, and a lot of the movie is pulled from his life. It's also pulled from the lives of friends of ours. We're both multi-generational San Franciscans, so we grew up on the stories of our parents' San Francisco and our grandparents' San Francisco. For me, a lot of that was in the 60s and the Haves. And for Jimmy, just down the street, it was the story of, you know, how his grandfather had built this house. And that was what he was raised to believe. And I think especially when things got dark and the family that had all been huddled under one roof living together was dispersed after they lost the house, Jimmy really held on to that story as something that carried a lot of weight for him, you know. And so the movie is not just about the house, but we also wanted to work through the idea of family stories and what they mean to us when we're going through difficult times.
It was I think in reflection now, a very unusual process. For us, it didn't feel unusual because it was the only one we've ever known. But I think it's not typically how movies get made. Part of that is, so it stems from, as I was saying, the conversations that Jimmy and I had growing up in San Francisco and wanting to turn those into a film. But what began with just the two of us quickly expanded in the early stages to this like film family that came together around the film. And part of that was that, you know, I'm a high school dropout. Jimmy has never acted in anything other than my film. So we knew that we weren't the most bankable pair in the world when we're saying, hey, do you want to give us a couple million dollars to make this movie? Most people in their right minds wouldn't trust us. And so we shot a very funky concept trailer early on that was essentially a very cheap version of the opening sequence of the movie where he skates through the city. But in our concept trailer, Jimmy was telling his grandfather's story that inspired the film. And I shot it and edited it and scored it, and we put it online. And it actually ended up being this accidental calling card where people started writing us, some from London actually, saying, like as I was saying, it's this Universal story, and we hadn't been aware of that before. But for people that were a bit closer to San Francisco, we got a bunch of letters saying, how can we help make this movie? I mean, it really was like this kind of groundswelling around the film. I still meet people today that go, I haven't seen the movie yet, but I gave you $10 on Kickstarter. So it did really tip into something. We were fortunate. But I think, you know, the small group that formed around it, many of them were also Bay Area based artists who were struggling with the same things. How can I survive here? And they really threw all of themselves into the movie. It's one thing for me and Jimmy because we grew up together, but to have this group of people who are just meeting us for the first time, like devote so much of themselves to something, it really was an integral part of this film, because not only was it difficult being a first film, but also San Francisco happens to be one of the hardest places in the entire country to make a film in. Very film averse, not a lot of funding in general in the U.S. for narrative films. But beyond that, it can be very expensive. And so, much like the wealth gap that exists in San Francisco, you know, outside of filmmaking, the movies that come there are often either huge Marvel films that go to blow up the Golden Gate Bridge, or they're tiny indie films that are sneaking under the radar made for like $200,000. And we lived in this precarious place where we're nothing close to the Marvel movies, but we had a little bit more than the very tiny indies. And so it was a constant struggle that took this Herculean effort from everyone involved to figure out how we could do something that was, for our budget, pretty ambitious. We had a lot of exterior shots, we had a big cast, kind of built this family that all developed the story together. So it was almost like a writer's room. As we were writing, we were scouting locations and casting. So we found that for us, it was very helpful to do it that way, because we'd find a location we loved and we would end up writing it into the movie. So, for instance, I think initially, probably in one of the first drafts, when Jimmy goes to see his dad, cut immediately to an interior. But we found this beautiful building with this stay sign on it. And so then we built the scene with this opera singer outside, who was someone else that we'd seen on one of our walks that we go on during our writing sessions, and we just start talking to him, and he influenced his character. So I feel like I enjoy that way of doing it, because I come from a family of journalists, and there was a sort of journalistic element to the research and the world building that we wanted to do, really trying to capture our San Francisco and archive it, because it's changing so quickly. Like, half the locations in the movie are unrecognizable at this point now, and we just, you know, shot a year ago, because it's changing that quickly. Like the housing projects, for instance, where Jimmy goes to the candy house in one brief scene, and the woman who runs the candy house is arguing with the guy at the front of the line. Those are very famous housing projects in San Francisco called Double Rock, and they've since been torn down. The area all around Montgomery's house looks very different. There are still groups that are fighting day and day to keep San Francisco this special, strange place that it has been for many years. I think what they're coming up against now are incredibly powerful forces, right? The money, there's never been money quite like this in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Even old San Francisco money is freaked out, you know? The Pacific Heights crowd, which is like really old money in San Francisco, mm-hmm. for a long time, I think they are not crazy about what's happening, which is kind of says a lot. It's tech. So San Francisco, you have outside of the Twitter headquarters, you'll find people with needles in their arms. And some tech workers who are moving there are probably appalled and want to understand what's happening. Mm-hmm. Many who you see, if you just were to go there on a random day and watch, will be stepping over people who are nodding off. Mm-hmm. And even worse, occasionally writing angry blog posts about the human feces on the ground. Rather than trying to understand who the human is that the feces came from, someone that may have lived in San Francisco long before you, may have even lived in an apartment that you were in and got pushed out themselves, it's like there's an apathy that I think is really invading the spirit of San Francisco. And it was not that way. Like, it used to be when we were growing up, you know, I knew all the homeless people in my neighborhood. You see them around the park, they're a part of your community. They're not a nuisance. Now they're treated like this despicable thing that no one wants to touch or to engage with, and so people pretend that they don't exist. Someone can be shouting on the streets in need of help, or sometimes just looking for someone to talk to. People walk by like nothing's happening.
Did you have like any concerns as a white man telling this story about the black community in San Francisco?
I think when you're talking about historically black films that have been made by white directors, I think that it's really important. It's a good question to ask, like, what is this director's connection to the story, right? And so I think it's a totally reasonable thing. I'd probably wonder the same things if I saw the film and then looked it up and saw that I had directed it. I think that in our case, it's really important that it comes out of a collaboration. And so it's not just me coming in, helicoptering in, and telling the story that I don't have any connection to. Jimmy and I growing up together in San Francisco, having a trust that not only as like a white man and a black man, but also as people that have known each other for a long time, have shared very intimate stories with each other, long before we ever started thinking about, oh, we want to make a film. I think that connection was very critical, because it's not just his experience, again, as an African-American San Franciscan, it's his actual life, right? Really imbued into the film. The scene with his mother is actually his mother. And they have a very specific relationship, you know? So I think that, you know, you should also ask Jimmy that question as well, because he can speak more to what that was like from his perspective. But from mine, it was important to really make sure that we were creating something together. And that went beyond just me and Jimmy. I think that extended to our whole team, which was a very diverse team. And, you know, my other partner, other than Jimmy on the film, creatively, was my lead producer, Kalia.
Lovely.
So Kalia Neal is from Oakland, which is right across the bay. Her family and her mom's side's from Hunters Point, where Montgomery lives in San Francisco. And Kalia is someone that reached out and took a big risk on us very early on. I would love for Kalia to get more shout-outs. If you guys are looking to write about a heroic producer, I mean, she reached out to us when we had very little recognition, long before A24 and Plan B came on, and helped us, like, actualize it. She was working with me in years for Isolation in San Francisco to figure out how we could turn this into a film. And Kalia, as my producing partner, we made every decision together. And so I think it's important that, like, it's not just on Jimmy's shoulders to sort of like shoulder that whole experience, but really as a team, hoping that the way that we work collaboratively, developing the story together, making sure that all decisions feel like there's conversations around it, there's an openness, that's like a part of the storytelling, so it's not just for me.
You bring this beautiful house, the skateboard, inanimate objects to life incredibly well in this film. How did you achieve this so that the audience becomes really invested in them?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, we would joke that Jimmy's skateboard is like his horse. You know, he's like a cowboy. He rides off into the sunset. Where he lays his hats is home. And when he breaks that skateboard, it's not just this inanimate object. It has deep meaning for him, because historically, you know, and this is true in Jimmy's life as well outside the film, it's like the skateboard is your way into different parts of San Francisco that you might not otherwise go to. It's like San Francisco was sort of a skate mecca in the 90s and early 2000s when we were growing up. And when Jimmy started skateboarding, he said he saw different parts of the city than he knew existed. So that was, that held a special importance.
The cinematography and the music design in this film is incredible and really adds to it. Can you tell me a little bit about that as well?
Man, like, I met two lifetime collaborators when we started making this film. One in Adam, our cinematographer. I met Adam 10 days before we shot the film. It was pandemonium. I had another DP who had shot a short that was going to do it. We lost him at the last second. And Adam stepped in and was a hero. I mean, we were shooting crazy long days and then shotlisting at night when he should have been sleeping. He could have very well come in this, like, under great duress at the last minute and had every excuse to, like, carve out some time for himself to be a human being. but he's so deeply obsessed and focused on like wanting to make sure everything feels right. At one point when he and I were sort of like in the throes of like pre-production, it was getting scary, we're 2 days out, we were sort of going back and forth, and he stopped me and he was like, I just want to make sure that I really honor this story because I know you and Jimmy have been living with your whole life. And I think every bit of passion he brings to it is like comes out of that. Like it's like a deep respect. So he's a special person. Really, really special. And Emil is similarly obsessive about his craft. Emil had never scored a feature film before. But he wanted to make a score that he felt was out of, he always says, Jimmy's heart. And so it's orchestral and almost like the music he wrote for the house. He always said he wanted to feel church-like. With the organs that are built in there and it being this sort of holy place for Jimmy in some ways. So I feel so lucky. Those guys made my dreams come true, and I feel like they really, it's a hard thing on a small budget to shoot San Francisco in that way and to make it sound the way that Emil does. And there aren't many people that could have done that, even accomplished DPs and composers.
What's it like to be added to sort of the A24 filmography and their list of sort of first-time feature directors?
Yeah, A24, it's an honor. I mean, they take huge risks, you know, and they really, I think, want, like, directors, they empower directors to, like, tell the stories they want to tell. I think a lot of people say they do that, and very few do. So there aren't many people I could imagine making this movie if not them.
That's great. So that was Joe Talbot at the London Film Festival, and if you're in the UK, Last Batman in San Francisco is out now. It was out in cinemas on October 25th, so you should still be able to catch it in the cinemas around this time. So now on to the main section of the show, and of course we do two films every week, and the first one up is Woodshock. This is written and directed by Kate and Laura Mulvey, and it's about a haunted young woman who spirals in the wake of a profound loss, torn between her fractured emotional state and a reality altering effects of a potent cannabinoid drug. This film stars Kirsten Dunst, Joe Cole and Pilo Asbeck. Now Lee, when did you first encounter this film, and was it a good shock or would shockingly bad?
Yeah, so this is one like obviously touched on like a year ago when we did this, like we considered ourselves A24 fans, but there was kind of a lot of kind of black spots in sort of our filmography watching, and this was one for me. And I've kind of alluded to this before in the past that I have a Letterboxd test where I'll like sometimes search for one of these sort of lesser known A24 films before we get to and just see what my friends thought of it, if it was kind of had a good consensus. This one I think had one person out of like 300 odd people I follow on it had seen it, which is pretty surprising for A24 films. You know, usually there's at worst maybe a few people have seen it, at most all of them have seen it. So this one was like, some alarm bells are going here. I mean, I was really interested in this because I love Kirsten Dunst and sort of the idea of her being in sort of a similar kind of depressive state, as it were, to Melancholia was interesting for me. And I was really interested, obviously, with the background the sort of directors have in design and, you know, I thought, oh, this could have something to it. But it was just one of those ones. It just, it's 100 minutes of... I don't know, I just couldn't connect with it. It was like, you know, there's hallucinations, some really interesting imagery, but I wasn't engrossed by sort of this plot with these poison-laced cannabis, you know, cigarettes, and there was just nothing about this film that worked for me at all. I was there, and when I'm watching a film for the first time, you know, the phone's put away, you know, anything like that, I just find myself just sort of looking at the phone, just, maybe I'll text Alice, you know, or, you know, I wonder what's going on in the football or things like that. This just film just didn't connect with me at all. It has some really interesting visuals, but there's just not enough there to kind of engage with the audience for 100 minutes at all, I'm sad to say.
I think I have to agree with you on this one, to be honest. This film, more than any other film so far that we have watched, proved the most difficult for me to get a hold of. Normally, you know, it's available on Blu-ray or DVD, or at the worst, you know, you get a foreign import of the film. You know, we've both sort of set up, you know, US iTunes accounts in order to try and get some of the films. But even then, it kept referring me back to basically an Amazon Prime account. But even beyond that, you needed a Shudder subscription in order to do it. So I basically had to sign up for Amazon Prime for free and then get a Shudder subscription for a week to basically watch this film. And it's safe to say that I basically cancelled both of them as soon as the film was over. And it was one of the most, sadly to say, one of the most boring films that I think I've watched in the A24 project. I couldn't even really say muster up the sort of hate or whatever of, to say that I, you know, it was bad. It was just boring. I couldn't even muster up that much enthusiasm to get, you know, angry about it. It was like Kirsten Dunst basically spends most of the film in this sort of dull sort of state of sort of shock and despair, and just sort of mopes around the screen all the time. And you know, obviously, you know, she's got these poison lace drugs, which, you know, joints that she's planning on smoking to kill herself, because, you know, she gave one of them to her mother to, you know, help her die in order to ease the pain of, I think it was cancer that she was suffering from. But then she starts to have this sort of guilt over that. Was it the right decision? Whatever. And then she's thinking about ending her own life. But then there's a weird side effect where it doesn't kill her, and she starts having these hallucinations, which, you know, ultimately are probably the best element of the film. The visuals and the sort of cinematography, I did enjoy. It just didn't have this story to back it up, unfortunately. I was reading on IMDb that Kirsten Dunst said that this was the most challenging role of her career, more than, you know, Melancholia was, I think, one that she mentioned. But I'm not sure how, because she seemed very sort of one note and monotonous throughout the whole thing, and that it's almost, you almost needed like a joint yourself or something to try and sort of take you out of this dull, boring state that you ended up being in Woodshock, I think.
Yeah, it seems like a sort of Cheech and Chong for the pretentious generation. Like, I can imagine this sort of playing well in sort of maybe like, you know, when you go to sort of like art schools or something like that, and they do the end of year kind of exhibit, and you sort of walk around, and like, there's this little dark room that you can go into. Like, you can imagine sort of just walking into one of those rooms and something like this playing and be like, oh, okay, like, yeah, that's kind of fine. But like, you know, it's like you don't sit there through the whole film. You kind of get up and kind of go out and check out the other kind of exhibits and so on. Like, I couldn't imagine someone sitting for 100 minutes and watching this one at all. And, you know, I sometimes think with drug you know, films, you know, I'm not a drug user. My drug is film. And you watch some things like this and you think, like, who is the audience for something like this? It's just hard to truly understand. Like, I maybe imagine that if you have, you know, you face kind of mental health challenges, like, you might be able to pull something from this film. I just was not able to get anything at all out of it.
Yeah, no, I mean, maybe there was like a connection there for some people, you know, who've maybe been through like a traumatic loss or something and have turned to something. But I mean, I was getting confused about, you know, drugs are illegal in the US, but for some reason, you know, the Pilo Asbeck, who's been in sort of Game of Thrones and stuff like that, you know, he's running this pretty much brazen open cannabis operation in a fully fledged store. It's like some sort of weird, you know, European vape sort of thing that he's got going on, although he just steals cannabis. So it's like, I was a bit confused by that. And, you know, there wasn't enough, certainly, like, relationship between, you know, Kirsten Dunst and him as sort of employer, or her so-called boyfriend played by Joe Cole as well. It's just, I didn't really get anything from them. And I think it's like, yeah, I was almost sort of feeling sort of stoned myself from watching it. I mean, I've never really been stoned, but I mean, I can imagine it'd be sort of that kind of dull, sort of numb feeling that I got, because, yeah, I just, like you, I just couldn't get any sort of real emotional connection to it, which is why I think I didn't feel angry or bad about it. It was just it felt just like a waste of 100 minutes, sadly, unfortunately, for me. And I can understand why it's one that has sort of almost disappeared and is very difficult for people to find. I'm not sure what A24 maybe saw in this. Perhaps it was maybe something in the script or something that they liked, but the final product for me just it wasn't really there, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think we're about to hit like a bit of a hot streak, and this film just isn't kind of going to be the one to kick that off. I think our next film is going to do that job quite well.
Yeah, I think it was a bit of a place of the sort of the calm before the storm, and the storm being a good storm, of course. And I guess if that brings us to the end of Woodshock, and you know, we normally sort of recommend you do watch all these films anyway, and you know, but it's not one which I'd, you know, particularly recommend to people. But if you are a completist, then absolutely give us a go. And you know, if you did see something in the film that we didn't, we'd love to hear your thoughts on it. But I'm sure we're going to have a lot more positive things to say about the next one, the film which inspired the name of the podcast, of course, in some ways. And this is The Florida Project, directed by Sean Baker. It's written by Sean Baker and Chris Burjock, who is a former guest of the show, and I guess Lee, you were lucky enough to chat to him for about an hour, and you've got a clip for us to play. Do you want to sort of tee that up?
Yeah, so here's a small extract from our interview with Chris. So in the show notes, you'll be able to find a link to an earlier episode of the A24 Project, so you can hear the full 70-minute interview. But here's just a little bit about sort of the making of the Florida Project and the inspiration behind it from one of the people involved in it themselves. Enjoy.
When you sort of decided, right, we can now start making this movie, it's cool, what was the research process like to be able to bring these kind of characters to the script and to develop a story for the film?
Oh, yeah. Well, I've joked before that I was researching this movie all my life because, you know, ever since the first time, 4 years old, that I went to Disney World, there were all these roadside places like the Magic Castle and the Wizard Gift Shop that I knew, like, I wanted to feature in the film. And a lot of times, just like with Donut Time in Tangerine, a lot of times we love stitching together locations into a script and figuring out, like, how could these locations serve a purpose in our script. So we were collecting ideas of places that we wanted to feature in the script and trying to weave a story through them. And that was the first step. And then the second step is we always had the ending. Ever since one of the initial phone calls when I was pitching to Sean, we always knew, I don't know how we always knew, but we always knew that we wanted the movie to end with this flight of fancy to the parks. And, you know, it went through a lot of, just as all scripts do, it went through a lot of morphing, evolving. You know, it wasn't always two girls who were friends. It was a little girl and a little boy with like a little romance in there. And the ages fluctuated and all that. But anyway, the basic premise of the fleeing, a dramatic flee from the motel was always there. And then you had to sort of reverse engineer it, if you will, and sort of figure out like what gets us there. So the whole thing was very unconventional the way we approached it. And then we took many trips. Sean and I would always, over the course of a year or two, yeah, like 2 years, we were, because before we even got financing, we were actually going down there because Sean was sort of curious to see it, and we would spend a week at a time in some of the motels and doing the same thing that I described trying to do with Tangerine. We're just walking around, introducing ourselves, telling people what we were looking to do, seeing if they would just tell us about their lives there, take them out to lunch. And I guess the main thing is to sort of not to get trust that we're not going to be exploitive and try to make them know what we're up to. And the more people could tell us, you know, about their lives there, the more it'll inform the script to be accurate. And so we really kind of got lucky with one day meeting a manager of one of the motels named John Manning, who was a huge, huge resource for us. Don't know what we would have done without him. And that, that's what it's all about. That's why you have to do the research when you're making movies like this, or else I'm not so sure how they're going to be accurate.
One thing people often talk about when they think about the Florida Project is either a testament to the writing or the acting or both, is how much of that script is
improvised by the actors and the kids, and how much free rein do they have, or are they very much actually working to a script but they just deliver it so well because you've put in that time and effort into research, and that the dialogue you're writing is true to these type of people and not just sort of generic kind of scripts?
Yeah, no, it's definitely okay. So there's always scripts, and let me back it up to Tangerine. So like on Tangerine, I'll give you a perfect example. You know, we had this script for Tangerine where a lot of times, so it was always important. You always have to get from A to Z in a scene, right? And the scene should always be moving it forward. And a lot of times there's little key bits of dialogue that need to be hit for that reason. But lots of times it was very collaborative with Maya and Kiki on the set, because let's say we had a line of dialogue in there, and it said something like, I'm trying to think here, it just said something kind of simple, like, that is not cool. And Maya would just be like, no way, I am not saying that. Like, all right, what's the problem, Maya? Why won't you say that? And she's like, you know, that is not what I would ever say. Okay, how would you say it then? And she would be like, that is not the tea. And, you know, that's an example of something I would have never written, that is not the tea. And you have this great line of authentic dialogue that rings true because of that. So it's basically this collaboration where she's saying the same thing that was written in her own way, and that really helps. But it's never completely improv, except in certain moments in Tangerine, there were those scenes where it's just like Cindy and Alexandra walk down the street and bicker. And we would just like need that little fill-in scene where we're following them walking, and we did want to encourage improv. And so we have lots of fun stuff with that. Now with Florida Project, that was more difficult because we actually had, you know, like 104 page, 102, something like that, page script. And so basically the kids, let me back up to casting. So that was a key issue for us. We needed children that could do both improv and memorize lines. And we were having a challenge finding one or the other. And so there were certain kids, we would create these sides, you know, like little bits of dialogue that you send to actors before they come to an audition, and they would be able to hit them great. Like they memorized every single word, word for word, and did it great. And then when we would do some, you know, little improv exercises, I remember one that we would always do because we knew the pool would play into the film. So we would just be like, all right, so there's these 12 and 13-year-old boys in the pool. They don't know that's your pool, so go kick them out. And they wouldn't know what to do. They just were, like, frozen, and they were just like, get out of the pool. So that was tricky. And then we would find other kids who could do that exercise amazing, and they were, like, cracking us up, but they were freezing up whenever you gave them the script. And they couldn't do that. They couldn't memorize lines or act them out. So that was a challenge. And when Brooklyn walked into the room, you know, we were getting into panic mode. There was only 1 month to go before production was supposed to begin. So we're in May of 2016, where we were scheduled to start shooting June. And we had no Mooney, and we had no Jancy. And it was terrible because we're like, are we going to have to delay production? The whole goal was that we wanted to shoot in the summer when the kids were off from school. And so then when Brooklyn walked in, it was amazing because she just walks in, and before we even get going, she walks into the room and she's just like, okay, before we begin, I've got to do my warm-up exercises. And she starts doing these like push-ups and we're just like, okay. And we're like already like thinking like this is so Mooney. And then she could do the, you know, do the lines of scripted. She could do the improv. And she was like our little good luck charm, because then once we knew we found our Mooney, everything started magically falling into place. And Sean discovered Valeria in Target with her mom and told her about the auditions we were having. And then she comes in and she clicked with Brooklyn so well. And they were such a great team. And Christopher Rivera, who played Scooty, and they can all do it all. And so then on set, we had an acting coach called Samantha Kwan, who was also just so invaluable and amazing, because she was working with the kids the whole time to have them memorize the lines. And literally really appreciate what each scene was about. So then when we're actually shooting, they're able to go off script and make it their own. And then you have this sort of mesh where they're following the script, and they're also making it their own. And it's this whole sort of like half and half thing where as long as, because you see, you can't really just have the kids improv, because then it's just, they're just going to talk about SpongeBob the whole time. And they're going to just want to, like, I remember all they kept doing was twerking, which is like a lot of it made it into the movie. You see a couple of those scenes, but like, that's all it would have been. So like, you need to keep them on script, but also let them do their thing, if that makes sense. Or else if you just kept them on script, like an Aaron Sorkin movie, you know, where they had to hit every single ellipses, you know, it wouldn't ring true. It just wouldn't feel natural.
One thing I'd read was that when Sean was looking to get Willem Dafoe involved, he sat down and Willem, compared to a lot of other people that were maybe interested in the role or you'd spoken to, he just got it in a way that a lot of other people didn't. What was it like to get someone like him involved? Was there a worry that when you think of your other kind of previous work and the rest of the cast, these are all unknowns, was there a worry that people might look at this and think, oh, that's that bad guy from that movie, or hey, that's that notable face? Was there any sort of worry about that? And what was it about this film that it really struck with Willem so much that he was like, I want to be involved?
Yeah, that's such a great question, you know, Lee, because like it is a concern, and we always write like, okay, so for me, like I was writing the script with the part of Haley with Britney Spears in mind, but we were never going to really, the thought was we would never actually approach Britney to play it. It was just sort of a framework for my mind to sort of picture. I really need to picture people when I'm writing a script, even if they're not going to play the role, if that makes sense. And so, and plus we thought Britney would be fun because of her Mouseketeer roots, so it'd be kind of meta. But the reason why I bring Britney up is because, you know, Sean is the one that's always saying, like, yeah, but we can't, it wouldn't really work for what I'm trying to do with this film to have international, you know, music star / millionaire Britney Spears playing this homeless woman. He wanted a fresh face. He really wanted a first-timer to play Haley. It makes real good sense. And so there's always that concern, and I think Sean had it for Willem, but we're both fans, you know, for a long time with him, and he liked Tangerine. And so Sean's agency set up a meeting. We were in Florida already in pre-production on this movie in the spring of 2016, and we got word that Willem would be willing to meet Sean. And Sean went up to New York just for the weekend, just to meet him, to sort of mention this to him and sort of, you know, gauge his interest. And he was ready, because he just liked, you know, what Sean was all about, the kind of films that he was doing. And Sean explained to him what the process would be like, and a lot working with a lot of first-timers. And I think, you know, from what I remember Sean saying, I didn't go to New York for that meeting, but he was very jazzed at that concept. It was like sort of a very intriguing concept for him to jump into something like this. And I think Sean sort of felt, in Willem's case, that he's such a guy who could fall into the role and lose, like, you know, that the Willem Dafoe-ness of Willem Dafoe, if that makes sense, and sort of like put the Green Goblin out of everybody's head, which all the kids loved him as, and you know, just fall into the role of Bobby. And it was also great because we originally had the role of Bobby, and Bobby had a right-hand man that we always were writing with, like a Steve Buscemi kind of guy in mind. And what we did was we combined those two roles, because now if you're going to have Willem Dafoe in the movie, you know, you got to give him more to do, right? And so it benefited the script in the sense that it kind of encouraged us to like combine those two roles and give Bobby more weight.
So that was Chris, and it's a really sort of fantastic episode. It's one of the best interviews I think you've done, Lee, and I think everyone should listen to the whole thing, and you should go and listen to it straight after we've finished talking about the Florida Project, I think. And that film, of course, is set over the course of one summer, and the film follows precocious 6-year-old Mooney as she courts mischief and adventure with her ragtag playmates and bonds with her rebellious but caring mother, all while living in the shadows of Walt Disney World in Florida. So, Lee, when did you first get introduced to the Florida Project, and what were your thoughts on first watch and then also on this rewatch?
Yeah, so I caught this at opening weekend, and I was really excited for this one because I was a huge fan of Sean Baker's previous film, Tangerine. And I don't know, I wasn't too sure kind of what mood I was in when I kind of went to see this one. I was really looking forward to it. And I sort of left and watched the film and I was like, yeah, that's a 3.5. It's good. I think I struggled a little bit with Haley. Like, I just found her quite a tough character to kind of sit through and watch and sort of what was kind of going on. There was things I really loved in the film, you know, Willem Dafoe, the kids' performances, the locations, you know, the events, some of the events in the film, really loved. But just, it just didn't all kind of come together perhaps on that first watch for me. And for me, I acknowledged that it was like, it was just wasn't working for me that day. So I remembered when it kind of came out on DVD, and it was one of these sort of like £6 pickups in FOP, and I grabbed it and rewatched it. And then it sort of really clicked for me that kind of I was a bit blocked by sort of this Haley character. I just found her quite just a difficult watch. I think sometimes, you know, you maybe get it with a film like Uncut Gems and some various other A24 films where the characters make really bad decisions or are kind of potentially unlikable, but you kind of go along with it. And I felt that kind of a little bit with the character of Haley here. And sort of when I sort of kind of took a step back and just sort of thought about sort of what kind of really unique character Haley is. And she is meant to be sort of loud, difficult, annoying. That's what the character is. And once I sort of accepted that, I was able to kind of completely get into the film and really enjoy it. And I definitely think it's definitely an A24 classic. I mean, we always ask, you know, guests that we have on the show, and you know, some of the talent, we ask, you know, what are the A24 films that you most enjoy, and the Florida Project is definitely one of them. I think it's just, it tells a social issue incredibly well, and I don't think many A24 films have that focus on that. They're more kind of character based. I think this has the balance of characters and telling a really fantastic social issue at the same time, and I think that's what makes it potentially one of A24's kind of top tier films. What about for yourself?
I think I first saw this, was there an Unlimited preview at Cineworld? I think there might have been, because I think that's when I first saw it. And I have to admit that on watching it, within the first sort of 5-10 minutes, I had a feeling, I was thinking, I was almost saying in my own head, I am going to hate this film. Because the kids at the beginning are so loud, screaming so much, and are so annoying that I thought, I'm not going to be able to cope with this. But to Sean Baker's credit, and to Brooklyn Price's credit, actually, the girl who plays Mooney in this, I ended up doing a complete 180, and by the end of the film, I was completely in love with it. I thought it was a fantastic film. I thought it was, I've really sort of ended up connecting with the characters. I thought they were all fantastic. You know, Mooney was great. Haley, like you say, she's a tough character, an awkward character. She does things that you may not agree with. Some would argue that she's doing them, everything she does is for the benefit of her daughter. I think you could certainly make an argument against that, and I'm sure that the basically child protection services who feature at the end of the film would argue that as well. And you know, these were two basically sort of almost first time actresses for this film, Bria Valente, who plays Haley, and then they were sort of then backed up with Academy Award nominee Willem Dafoe, and also Academy Award nominated for this film as well. Having that sort of safe pair of hands in there sort of really helps sort of ground the film and bring it all together. And just like you, I was a huge fan of Tangerine. You know, everyone has been making a lot of fuss over Steven Soderbergh over the last couple of years for doing Unsane and High Flying Bird, filming them all on an iPhone. But Sean Baker was like, been there, done that, and I would say made a better film on an iPhone, because Tangerine I thought was just fantastic. Some of the cinematography he managed to get out of a iPhone 5, I think it was, with a fisheye lens, is just incredible. And once again, using a mixture of established actors and sort of new people that he just met on the street and sort of bringing them into this world, I thought was a fantastic sort of concept. And he's done it again with this, like you say, sort of telling an intimate sort of family story, almost a sort of coming of age thing as well, because, you know, the character of Mooney does have a lot of growing up to do. She's living in, I almost sort of watching it a second time on this rewatch here with the, there's a scene where her and her friends end up burning down some of these empty condos in on the outskirts of Orlando and stuff like that. And it sort of reminded me of The Big Short. You know, there's that sort of scene where Steve Carell's lackeys head down to Florida to see the true extent of this housing bubble that was about to burst. And you sort of see some of the fallout of that. And I thought it was an interesting sort of kind of double bill almost you could do with the two of them, sort of seeing that. And obviously you've got the two sides, you know, you've got this whole, the glitz and the glamour and of the money of Disneyland. Well, it's not Disneyland because it's apparently it's Walt Disney World in Florida, but then you've got all these people who sort of work in the parks and around the parks and stuff like that, and they're living in these sort of motels, and it's, they're not just staying for a couple of days, they're basically living there. You know, there's the scene where Willem Dafoe basically has to almost evict them for a night so they can't then sort of claim any sort of residential rights and stuff like that. So you get a real, so it's a real eye-opener to the sort of almost behind-the-scenes world of Disney. And, you know, it's not all, you know, princesses and stuff like that, although I'm sure some people would say that maybe Mooney is a bit of a Disney princess, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's... I suppose when, at this rate, kind of Disney are kind of buying up things, it won't be long before A24 is a subsidiary of Disney, and she becomes an official Disney princess alongside
the May Queen of Midsummer as well.
Exactly. But yeah, I think like the casting here was pretty impressive. I think Willem Dafoe as well, and sort of this role as well, really kind of stood out as well. Like, it was just so lovely to see him. You know, he's seen him in so many kind of different roles, and this is just, he's just someone that is a salt of the earth, genuinely lovely guy. And I think it could have been quite easy to go wrong, really. And I don't mean that in a reflection of Willem Dafoe's kind of acting or anything at all like that, but you think of an actor like that, you kind of look at him and think, oh, that's Willem Dafoe, whereas everyone else here is unknowns. They're people picked up from Target, you know, Instagram models, all these sorts of things. It could be easy to sort of have that take you out of the film, but I think he kind of complements all these other characters so well, and you don't look at him thinking, oh, that's Willem Dafoe, big Hollywood star. You think of that, oh, that's Willem Dafoe in this really great role, and you kind of get immediately sort of wrapped up in Bobby's kind of just how nice he is and how well he goes to bat for all these characters. Even when he's evicting them, he's still trying to find ways to get them somewhere else to stay.
I know, it's like, what I think is it actually sort of has a lot of parallels with American Honey as well. You know, you've got these people who are like living in these motels or on the road and stuff like that. And Andre Arnold sort of did a similar thing, you know, Sasha Lane and many others were sort of picked up off the street to star in these films, but then you've got someone like Shia LaBeouf, who's an established actor, whatever, to help sort of rein in the performances and sort of bring it all together. And yeah, what I really loved about Bobby's character was the fact that, like you say, he could have maybe been this sort of stereotypical sort of landlord, sort of hotel manager, owner, sort of maitre d' type character, but it was actually refreshing to see how much he was a sort of paternal sort of father figure to everyone who stayed in his motel, and he was always trying to look out for them and make sure they were okay and do the best and see right by them all as well. So that was really a refreshing change to see, because, you know, just from, you know, the other A24 film that he's done, The Lighthouse, you know, that is quite sort of broad and out there, but this is a very subtle sort of restrained performance, I think, from him. If you think, you know, of something like the Green Goblin and the Spider-Man films, where he goes and sort of bats it out of the park, you know, this is much more quiet. And, you know, he was nominated for Academy Award, you know, but he never has that, maybe that sort of big moment that people would have in their highlight reel. But, you know, it was just a really sort of genuine performance. And I think, like you say, it helps to balance the sort of the uninitiated actors and stuff like that. I mean, and I think a lot of credit must go to the sort of writing and also the direction by Sean Baker as well, because we both saw another film that had Bria Valenti in it at the Edinburgh Film Festival this year, and it was one of our least favourite films of the year, and I didn't think that she was all that great in it. So I think perhaps a lot of it does come down to the director and working with them in order to bring out a really good performance.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's the big thing about, like, I think people have loved this cast, and I think what's sort of the thing that's probably exploded more out of the film than anything is the kind of imagery of this film that I think probably, I would say, Midsommar, The Florida Project, and The Witch seems to have sort of inspired the most artwork and design and illustrations and creativeness. You know, you think of people designing Black Phillip tattoos and imagery, you know, Midsommar, like, it's just been Halloween, everyone's doing May Queens and, like, inspires people. Florida Project, like, people are going and visiting the locations, they staying at the hotels, people are drawing pictures and amazing kind of designs. I think, like, it's really interesting that those three films seem to have kind of evolved even beyond sort of film passion and love for A24 fans.
Absolutely. I've just now in my head, I was reading all these articles about the Joker steps in Brooklyn and about all the residents complaining that they're getting over bombarded by idiots dressed up as a Joker dancing for Instagram, and how it's getting gentrified. And I can just imagine that there's probably some people who stay at the Magic Castle who are maybe, are they going through a similar thing where the hotel was, certainly in the film, was considered almost sort of a last resort for people, but maybe it's sort of turned around and now it's sort of this chic, you know, sort of bespoke hotel for film fans who are visiting Walt Disney. They don't want the Disney experience, they want the Magic Castle experience. And I wonder if it's seen a change in the clientele and who visits that and whatever. But it's somewhere that if I ever get back to Orlando, I would certainly, and Disney, I would certainly be wanting to pay a stop. I don't really remember it. I was over, probably, I think it's 2005, I think I was in Disneyland. I certainly remember some of the locations, like the store that has, like, the big giant wizard in it. I remember driving past that, certainly, but I don't remember the Magic Castle. But it's a place and a location that would be hard to forget when you see it now, because it's just so, it's almost now as iconic as the main Disney castle, which they run towards at the end in that infamous scene now, where it's fair to say they probably did not have permission to film, so it was all done on the fly. What did you make of the ending? And I guess we're sort of skipping to the ending here at this point, but we can come back to a couple of other points. But what did you make of the ending? Because I've seen some sort of people sort of almost hint that it maybe isn't real, maybe it's like a dream or a fantasy sequence. What did you make of that wonderful sort of uplifting ending?
Yeah, I know Sean Baker sort of wanted to kind of leave it ambiguous. For me, you know, I suppose it's been inspired sort of by the kind of conversation I had with Chris. He was one of the kind of lucky people to sort of be part of this guerrilla crew that went and sort of stormed Disney and filmed this scene. Like, he was like, you could technically get from the hotel to Disney in, like, I think it was like 10 to 15 minutes, which seems kind of realistic. Like, part of me just believes that on a kind of level of, like, you want this character to get a lucky break. I mean, I work with people that face kind of a lot of difficulties and barriers in their life, and people often just like, oh, I just want someone to take a chance on me, I just want a lucky break, just one thing to go well for me. And I think in this whole film, like, I think that's the one moment where it all goes well. Like, at her absolute worst, just this one thing goes right, that she gets to Disneyland and maybe has this little adventure before it's all kind of taken away from her. And my feeling is it did happen, and it could happen. You know, the odds of it happening are quite slim to kind of get that far to get into Disney, but I like to think the odds are maybe on her side. What about for yourself?
I think I was in an optimistic mood when watching this and was hoping for the happy ending. Obviously, you know, there's not, rather pointedly, there's not a shot of them going through the turnstiles, but everything else looks like, I think they would have, it would have been a case of them, like, sneaking under or pretending to be with another family. And I think, having sort of gone from potentially hating the character at the very beginning to actually feeling sort of an affection for her and wanting the best for her, I would like to think that it was real and she got her Disney happy ending, it's a small world after all thing at the end. Because, you know, there was a moment for me when I think the film all sort of clicks together, and there's a sequence where she's sort of going through her summer, she's sort of playing and stuff, but then you see her in the bath, having a bath, but then you see this maybe sort of like three or four times, and it's an odd, initially it's quite a jarring sort of thing. It's like, what? Okay, it's an interesting choice for him to show her constantly having a bath and stuff like that. But then there's a scene where a guy walks in, is about to go to the toilet, and then realizes that there's a kid in the bath, and it turns out that her mum has been basically taking men back to the hotel, prostituting herself in order to make money for the both of them, and she's basically then sort of locked Mooney in the bathroom in order so she doesn't have to witness what her mum has been doing. And then this is what ultimately, of course, then leads to her downfall and the sort of removal of Mooney by Child Protection Services. And that was a sort of real sort of heartbreaking moment when you realise the reason for that. And I think that's when the whole sort of film sort of started to really come together for me. And it's when I started to really feel a connection with it and feel sorry for the character. And that's what did it for me, I think. What about yourself?
Yeah, and then kind of when it follows on that she steals the bands from his backpack and kind of sells them on, like, this person, like, you know, kicking up shit, you know. And again, I think it all kind of comes together that you feel sort of pity for the kind of character, but you're like, yeah, fuck that guy and stuff like that, you know. She's someone that's looking to try and make ends meet, and, you know, ultimately it's kind of driven her to something like this. But, you know, Willem Dafoe is there to kind of try and help the best way he can. And for this character to almost get the comeuppance of, like, you know, he thought he could go fuck around on the side and in Florida and get away with it. Well, not quite. You know, he's going to have to pay out for a new set of bands, etc. I just think that's a great moment, and it kind of shows all the characters that they're most interesting.
Yeah, because I know it's actually it's Macon Blair, who is in Blue Ruin and Green Room, also on the A24 project. And, you know, it's a thing where, you know, sort of, it was only on the second viewing I sort of pieced it together that she might not have actually taken those wristbands. I think she almost did it out of annoyance and spite at him walking in on her daughter, I think, and then she tries to sell them. And then, you know, she does bad things, you know, it's undeniable, but, you know, it all does come from a good place. Like at the end where they sort of wander into a hotel and sit down and have breakfast pretending to be staying at the hotel, and you then realise it's just her trying to do one final nice thing for her daughter, because she knows that when she gets back to the hotel the police and stuff are going to probably be there, and she's gonna lose her. And it's just a really sort of heartbreaking moment. And I think Sean Baker does a great job at sort of bringing that sort of protective nature out of the character of Haley at that point. And you can't help but sort of sympathise and empathise with her at that point. And I think it's just a fantastic sort of film and a fantastic performance from her.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one that I think it's a really special kind of film. And as I said earlier on, it's a rare A24 film that tackles a social issue head on. And it's, you know, I imagine that many of those hotels are still kind of facing the same issues and the same people. And it'd be interesting to know where these characters are kind of almost 3-4 years on.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, everyone, I think, who goes to Disneyland and whatever, I think I certainly probably didn't think about that side of the tracks at that point. But I know if I did go back, I would have a bit, I think, my head a bit more screwed on and not be so dazzled by the bright lights of it and whatever, and know that, you know, in order for, you know, myself and others to have a really good time, there are people who are sort of working there who are sort of struggling and, you know, need to make ends meet whatever way they can. And, yeah, you know, hopefully you know, everyone will get their happy ending in the end after all, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's sometimes the best we can hope for.
Absolutely, and speaking of happy endings, that brings us to the end of another episode. So we're going to be back in 2 weeks' time with another fantastic episode, and we have a bumper episode lined up for you. We've got two cracking films. We've got The Killing of the Sacred Deer, the follow-up to The Lobster by Yorgos Lanthimos, and I think I've said that correctly. And then it's a big one, Lee. It's the first spot for the Gerwig. It's Lady Bird. Are you excited for this one?
Yeah, definitely. We haven't recorded our parts yet, but you know, we're gonna have an interview with Robert Eggers next week. We're gonna have segments with some two incredible kind of film fans as well, and we're gonna have a really great guest, Clara, on to discuss the two films with us as well. So I think this could be our kind of biggest bumper episode yet. It's like an early Christmas special, we'll say.
Absolutely. I mean, if anyone's listened to our Moonlight episode, which an American Honey episode, which was nearly as long as American Honey, I think we could go one better, and I think we could be approaching sort of Lord of the Rings Irishman sort of lengths here, but it will all be done in the best possible ways, and it certainly won't feel like a 3-hour long podcast. I think we've got a lot of great guests on and a lot of interesting different viewpoints, and I think it's going to be a great discussion. So hopefully you'll be able to join us in a couple of weeks, and we'll see you then. Cheers. Bye bye.